It flows through Genesis in the 20th chapter. I'm going to read the chapter in its entirety. Follow along with me as I read, please. Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. But for a while he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said to his wife Sarah, "She is my sister." Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman." Now Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, "Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And didn't she also say, 'He is my brother'? I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience, and so I've kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and he will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all yours will die." Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, "What have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done." And Abimelech asked Abraham, "What was your reason for doing this?" Abraham replied, "I said to myself, 'There is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, "This is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother." Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and in return Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "My land is before you. Live wherever you like." To Sarah he said, "I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. This is to cover the offense against you, and before all who are with you, you are completely vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girl, so that they could have children again. For the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah. In Greek mythology, there is a man by the name of Achilles. Achilles was the mightiest warrior on the Greek side during the Trojan War. He was the son of Peleus and the sea nymph Thetis. They tried to make Achilles deathless. And as the story goes, their process was to take him and to put him in fire at night and by day rubbing him with ambrosia. Well, this didn't work. So Thetis took Achilles and she dipped him in a river. And this dipping in the river made him deathless, except for the fact that one part of his body was not touched by the water into which he was dipped, and that was the heel that his mother held as he was dipped. The Trojan War began, and Thetis did not want Achilles to go to battle. She disguised him as a woman. And one day Ulysses was out looking for warriors, particularly Achilles, and suspicion that he might have been disguised by his mother, and he came upon this group of women who were weaving, and he had some goods. He had some weapons as well as some woman's goods, things that women would have been interested in, pots and pans and Tupperware, you know, that kind of thing. And this one of the women, who was not a woman, but Achilles, he showed interest in the weapons, not in the woman's goods. He was identified by Ulysses, and he was drafted into the war, the Trojan War. Achilles fought hard at Troy. He killed many men in battle. But one day in battle, he was killed himself. Paris shot an arrow at Achilles, and Apollo took the arrow and guided it right toward Achilles' heel. The heel had not been dipped in the river, and this brought him to his end. And so coming down through the years in our language, we have the terminology Achilles' heel. Because when we say, use that terminology, we think of a place that's vulnerable, a point or an area of weakness. And that is just what we have under study in Genesis 20, a point of weakness, an area of vulnerability in Abraham's life. Abraham is not the only believer who has had an area of weakness. I can name a few for you. They're interesting studies. Solomon, David, Samson. Their area of weakness? Women. Lack of self-control. Peter, impulsiveness. Jeremiah, self-pity. John, temper. David, emotions. Jacob, deceit. Timothy, timidity. Euodius and Syntyche, pettiness. Mark, indecisiveness. Thomas, the pessimist. Jonah, prejudice. Areas of weakness. No, not man's sin. Yes, sin. And in every life, it was an area which hindered them. It encumbered their growth in the Lord and caused some serious problems in the advancement of the plan of God. We have in Genesis 20 the example of a man who has an area of weakness. We've studied him for some weeks now, and he's Abraham. And it's interesting in studying the life of Abraham because we have seen Abraham achieve some great victories. Think of what he's done. He has taken a journey from the Ur of Chaldees. He's trusted the Lord to go where he didn't know he was going. He left. And the Lord revealed it to him on the way where he was to go. He won great battles. He defeated one of some of the greatest armies in the world of his day with just a handful of men. He trusted the Lord that God was going to provide him with seed, with a child, at a very old age. Sure, he had his times where he faltered, but he trusted the Lord along the way for that. He was an intercessor. He prayed for Lot and his family. He prayed for the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah that they would be spared. You see all these great exploits by Abraham, but the Bible reveals an area of weakness. We've already studied this area of weakness once in Abraham's life, recorded back in Genesis 12, when he went to Egypt in his initial visit to the land. Abraham's area of weakness, and this area was an area of vulnerability for 30 years at least. A lack of truthfulness, deceptiveness. He would not be truthful, and that resulted in the tragedy we're going to see in the 20th chapter of Genesis. But you know, we are like Abraham. We have our great victories, and I think probably most handle the big problems. We handle the big things, but it's the so-called little sins, as it says in Song of Solomon, the little foxes that spoil the vines. We experience over the victory over the big things. We don't murder anyone. We're faithful to our wife. We rear our children before the Lord, but we worry. We pray. We study our Bible. We control our temper, but we don't control our tongue. We have areas of weakness. Now, we're all susceptible to sin because we all have a sin nature. But for reasons which I will go on to show you later on in this study, there are certain areas in our life where this sin nature has in a special way embedded itself. And it's taken root. And there is a special area of weakness in our life. Now, let's look at Abraham as the background for this in chapter 20. This chapter moves in three parts, verses 1 and 2, Abraham's transgression. Now, Abraham has moved. Why did he pick up his tent and go to the south and to the west? We don't know for sure, but he did. He has been living here at Hebron, as you'll notice on the map, and he moves to a place called Gerar. It's on the Philistia, plain of Philistia. It's out to the south of the city of Gaza, 10 miles south of Gaza, to be exact. So this is where he has moved. This has taken him into the domain of one Abimelech. Now, Abimelech is a title name. That's not his personal name. It means the king is my father. It's what is called a dynastic title, like Pharaoh. So Abraham journeyed, and he came, and he settled between Kadesh and Shur, and dwelt in the city of Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, and she's 90 years old at this time, and he wants her to follow through with the same policy that began 25 years earlier, to tell him that she was his sister. Now, this says something for Sarah. She must have been quite a looker at 90 years of age. I mean, that's the only explanation. Now, it's true that kings like to stash their harems with various nice-looking women, and not always for sexual reasons, for political reasons. Abraham was a very wealthy man. He would have seen this woman traveling with Abraham. Abraham judges him wrongly and thinks that Abimelech would not respect the laws of ownership and relationship and would take Sarah away. And that perhaps by including her in his harem, this would be politically and monetarily, as well as personally, a real find for him. She must have been a good-looking woman. And at 90 years old, she's still looking pretty good. And Abraham wants to avoid personal loss. He doesn't want to die. Don't blame him for that, but he's forgotten who is the one who's to protect him, who is the one who's called him. And so they engage in this lie, and Sarah becomes a part of the harem of Abimelech. Now, Abraham's transgression involved three people. Watch this. Number one, Abraham's transgression was personal, the sin of unbelief. God had promised Abraham that he's going to have a child. He will have a son. He's thinking that he's going to be killed. He's trying to second-guess God. So he engages in this policy of deception. Abraham sinned against Sarah. He jeopardized Sarah's future and her character by allowing her to be taken into the harem of Abimelech. He didn't know that Abimelech would not touch her sexually. He didn't know that. Now, God overruled and worked to keep him from doing this. But he jeopardized his wife's own character. You'll see something about the nature of sin and what an area of weakness can do. It doesn't affect just the one, personal, just the person, but it affects others. He was more interested in protecting himself than he was in protecting his wife. And thirdly, he sinned against Abimelech. He caused this man, as well as all of those associated with Abimelech, to be drawn in under the judgment of God. He contributed to Abimelech's troubles, set a bad example before an unbeliever. And I have no reason to believe that he was a believer, other than, and he did have a very high system of morality, but that's not the same as being a believer. He had a lot of integrity. But here is Abraham setting a terrible example before an unbelieving king. Verses 3 through 7, we get God's intervention into the matter. God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night. God is not limited in his use of dreams to just believers. He can appear to unbelievers. He did with Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel chapter 4. And so God is revealing himself in this dream. He says, as we've read already, Abimelech, you're as good as dead. And God was in the process of judging this family because of what had happened. He vouches for his own integrity. Then he goes on to say to him in the dream in verse 6, I know of your integrity. God is aware of that. But I have kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, how did God do this? Well, we'll know from a little bit later on that apparently God sent to Abimelech a sexual disorder, perhaps impotency or some kind of sexual disorder, not only to him but to others in his household. It is the providence of God overruling, and it's a word of encouragement that in spite of one's area of weakness and the repercussions that area may have in life, it doesn't cause God to lose control of his plan. That God's plan is greater than even our failures and our weakness. That's not an excuse for the weakness, but it's an encouragement as we begin to look at the weakness, that God is greater than. He's greater than Abraham's sin. He's greater than his weakness. He's sovereign over Abraham. He protects Abraham from losing the promise that he had given to him. He protects Abimelech by not allowing him to take this man's wife under the guise of it being his sister. Three, he protected Sarah herself from adultery. God can overrule our failures and protect us from ourselves. That's not an excuse for sin, but it says something about it does offer some comfort in what God does, maybe more than we realize. God protects us from ourselves. You know what God will often do? God will often, in those years when we're trying to mature and there is that area of weakness, he will put up hedges and he will protect us, and until we can come along to that place where we can begin to mature and that area of weakness can be handled. Some of you have an area of weakness, and it's only by the providence of God that he's protected you from not making a greater mess of things than you have. That ought to keep you off from any self-righteous horse to think that, though I haven't fallen, but you have an area of weakness, and the reason you haven't fallen more than you have in that area is God's been putting up a lot of protection that you may not even be aware of. This is what he did for Abraham. Now we have the command in verse 7 to restore this man's wife. He says Abraham's a prophet. First occurrence of the word, it's Navi. The word Navi means to be a proclaimer. Abraham has a special relationship to God. He's going to pray for you because of this special relationship as a prophet, as God's representative. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. Verses 8 through 18, Abimelech's restoration. Now, who comes off looking the more noble and the one who has the greater integrity here? Abimelech, an unbeliever. He puts to shame a believer. Here's the case where an unbeliever's own morality or behavior rebukes that of a believer. That's tragic. But it happens. Abraham is rebuked by a man of the world. How humiliating. How humiliating for a believer to have to be rebuked by an unbeliever. Now, there are several things Abimelech does to restore his wife. Number one, he rebukes Abraham himself. Verse 8, 9. He simply asks, in so many words, whatever possessed you to do this, Abraham? Look who's talking to whom. Abimelech, this unbelieving king, but with integrity, speaking to Abraham, who's talked with God, who's lived with the Lord, what did you do? Whatever possessed you to do this? He drops his head. And what's really pitiful is that Abraham has the audacity to offer some excuses. Look at those excuses in verses 11 and 12. Because I thought, sure, there's no fear of God in this place. Abraham is trying to second-guess God. He's doubting the protective ability of God. Secondly, she's actually my sister. It hasn't been all that bad, because she is really my half-sister. He doesn't still seem to see the awfulness of it and the seriousness of it. And thirdly, in verse 13, look how he words this. It came about when God caused me to wander. He's blame-shifting. This word to wander here in the Hebrew is a word that is never used in a good sense in the Old Testament. There are seven different words translated to wander. This particular word looks like this in the Hebrew. It is ta'ah. That's T-A-A-H. Ta'ah. never used in a good sense. It's used or translated to go astray, to err. It's used of a drunk who staggers. You know what he's doing here? God got me into this problem. And it seems that if he's insinuating that he's had to adopt this policy to protect himself because God forced him out of the land and made him do all this, that is blame shifting. And we should add this in right here. You will never be able to handle your own weakness unless you will take personal responsibility. We'll come back to that in a bit. But that's a principle. Mark it down. Then, after rebuking Abraham, restoring Sarah, as it is called, said in verse 14, he remunerates Abraham and Sarah. This is to not pay them off for the sin, but rather to vindicate before all who would ask by a huge sum of money. This silver that he gives them, 1,000 pieces, may be worth over $500,000. To be some kind of a reminder of the vindication of Abraham and Sarah. And the man with integrity, Abimelech, wants them to go, and there not to be any shadow be cast over their own lives. Let them to know that everything is fine. And so God prospers Abraham, not because of his sin, but because God had promised him that in the covenant, and he's remunerated. And then the Lord answers Abraham's prayer as Sarah's been restored. Verse 18, the Lord had closed up fast all the rooms of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. There's the account. Abraham's transgression, God's intervention, Abimelech's restoration. Now let's take this. How to handle, identify and handle your area of weakness. How to identify and handle your area of weakness. I want to offer you 7 principles. Number 1, the first step, look at your past in a Christ-centered way. Look at your past in a Christ-centered way. Now, I'm not asking you to review your past in a sin-centered way. You'll get depressed. If you're given to self-pity, you will feel sorry for yourself. You do it to prepare for the future. You relate your past to the grace of God. Look at your past in a Christ-centered way. You may divide your past up by the watershed of the cross. Before you were saved and after you were saved. Before your conversion, how did you most often fail? In what areas did you most often fail before you became a Christian? Now, you may have to make yourself become definite here by writing something down. So take a pencil in hand and begin to... You might just want to put a little graph and do it this way. And look back over your life before you were saved and sort of just chart some of the ups and downs as best you can remember. Where'd you fail here? Why'd you fail here? There. Do you see any consistency? Of inconsistency? Do you see anything that keeps coming up again and again? What has brought you sorrow, regret, and trouble most often? Then also, as you look at your past, look at your life since you've become a Christian. What sin have you found yourself most often confessing? Not criticizing the confession. The confession will not mature you. It only places you in a position where you can mature. I've had people say to me, well, I've confessed the sin time and time again, but I just don't seem to be any better. Well, my friend, you do not understand that confession is not designed to take you on, to strengthen you, to resist the problem. It just recovers you. It's God's license for service. So you can get back into position to serve the Lord. It's not a license to sin again and again and keep confessing. So it's after conversion. What sins have you most often committed? Is there a pattern? Secondly, consider the failures of your mother and father, also grandparents. Consider the failures of your mother and father, also grandparents. And I might add here, your own children. For often our weaknesses show up in our children. This is the principle of the sins of one generation becoming visited upon the second and third generation. Not because that second and third generation don't deserve it, but it's like this. You get chain sinning from one generation to the next. Let's put it like this. Here are grandparents, and here parents, here you are. Now I ask you, as you look back up the line, do you see, and take it out this way, your children? You might add your wife or your husband, as the case may be, because sometimes they can mirror your own weakness. Not that they necessarily absorb it, but how they bounce off of it. We'll go into that a little later on. What kind of problems is this created for them? So here you are looking at the picture. If you want to use genealogy for a good positive purpose, besides that of trying to find blue bloods in your tree, do it this way. Grandparents, parents, children, what do you see? Do you see any trends? When you consider your own parents, did they argue a lot? When they did, why did they argue? How did your parents, why did they most often have a falling out with one another? If they're divorced, what brought on that divorce? You might even want to do this if you have a good talking relationship with your parents, and probably if they are maturing believers, talk with them. They might be able to give you some insight on yourself. But do this. Look at your brother, your father, your grandparents, your children. What problems do you see coming up in here? I think I'm seeing one that's taking place right now. I hope I can do something to help correct it. I'm seeing it on some young men that I have some responsibility for a few times during the week and not associated with this church. So none of you know these people at all, except for one. And I think I'm seeing a pattern develop that has already begun. I've had the opportunity to coach two different fellows, they're brothers, and I'm seeing something develop in these young lives. What will be for them a serious area of weakness because it's not being handled right now? And this is one of the most serious, resistance to authority. Resistance to authority. And I can't jump the gun. I'm still trying to get all the information on it as I'm trying to deal with the problem. But I'm wondering, to what degree is there parental resistance to authority? And you can see it begin to come up in the children. So that's why I ask you to do this. What weaknesses, you might ask this, what weaknesses have you been most often criticized about? You know, one of the most important things we can learn in life as a Christian is how to handle criticism. That tells a lot about your character, how you handle criticism. If you're the kind of person that cannot handle criticism, you are limiting yourself severely to maturing in the Lord. If you carry your feelings on your sleeves and you cannot handle criticism, I'm not talking about whether it's justified or not justified. That isn't the point. You may not have any control over what comes your way in criticism. Is it justified? Is there any consistent pattern in these criticisms that I have received? Is there something that I have been criticized about a number of times? Is there anything to it? Please don't walk around and say, well, they sure don't understand me. Now, they may be wrong. They're not God, obviously, and they cannot play God in your life and offer omniscience about your weaknesses and strengths. But do you see anything in those criticisms that have come your way most often? Thirdly, identify the weaknesses you are quick to see and condemn in others. Identify the weaknesses you are quick to see and condemn in others. Now, I insert a caution here. I don't want to get you paranoid. I'm not suggesting that when you see a sin and react strongly to it, that you are guilty of that sin. No, what I am saying is that sometimes, let's take, you know, when you get two proud people, let's take one very proud person. A proud person is really going to be bouncing off a lot of other proud people. Or you get a room full of self-righteous people, and you're going to get all kinds of sparks. What I'm saying is that you might be looking at and condemning this sin out here, and maybe that toothpick out there is the telephone pole in your eye. At least examine it in that way. It may not be true, but identify the weaknesses you are quick to see and condemn in others. Could it be yours? Could they be yours? Am I susceptible to these sins? 4. In the Spirit, study and understand what sin is and what it can do. In the Spirit, study and understand what sin is and what it can do. Never study sin in a sin-centered way, but always in a Spirit-centered way as a means of putting it off and walking in the Spirit and growing in Christ. I must see the matter of weaknesses from God's standpoint. Abraham apparently didn't. Abraham is trying to justify his weakness. But look what sin does. Sin dishonors God. This area of weakness dishonors God. It will destroy you. It will make you less sensitive to other areas in your life, other sins. It will destroy others, like the effect of Abraham's sin on Sarah and Abimelech and his household. You take Thomas with his sin of pessimism. There are three interesting episodes in Thomas's life. They are all recorded in John. John 14:5, 11:16, and 20:24. Thomas appears to be an incurable pessimist, almost a cynic. And Thomas must have been a negative force and influence on the lives of the other apostles. Had to be in the way he handled himself in view of looking at impossible situations, a pessimist. And furthermore, sin in the area of weakness will further Satan's plan, just like it was doing with Abraham. Do you not see how that Abraham stepped right into the game plan of Satan at this point? And this has contributed to another attack of Satan on the seed of the woman. Do you realize how close it came for interrupting this line of the seed of the woman, what Abraham did? I want to tell you, it's serious in this matter of an area where we're particularly vulnerable and not handle it, that it can cause serious or openness to satanic attack on our life and disruption of an effective testimony. Let's go to the fifth principle. Take personal responsibility for my area of weakness. Take personal responsibility for my area of weakness. Do not try to blame it on others. I have not suggested by emphasizing parents, grandparents, children, you will not shift the blame and say, oh, I'm this way because my parents were that way or because their parents were that way. No. Every generation is responsible for their own decisions and what they are. Children are responsible for what they do and what they are. And I cannot blame it on somebody else. I may have learned these things from them, but I learn them, and I am responsible. So I must accept responsibility. I cannot say that that's just a personality flaw. I believe that some Christians hide behind this thing of personality. They say, like, that's just the way I am. Well, are you bragging or complaining? Just the way you are. Why in the world, then, do we have commands to be holy, to be righteous, to be Christ-like? If we were to say, that's just the way I am, some Christians hide behind this matter of personality and as an excuse for behaving the way they've always behaved and continuing to behave that way. Or saying, I'm too old to change. Or, It's not hurting anyone else. Or, someday I'll change. Just give me some elbow room. Now, it's true that if you're living with a person and you recognize the area of weakness, you have to learn the doctrine of forbearance. That's putting up with one another while we're maturing. Because you've got your area of weakness too. But you go back and look at Abraham's excuses, and you're seeing him do the very thing, the opposite of the thing he needed to do, accept responsibility, but he was indulging in blame shifting. He tried to justify, he tried to rationalize, he tried to excuse his sin. And we'll never handle our area of weakness when we try to blame it on somebody else. Well, it's my husband's fault, it's my wife's fault, it's my mother's fault, it's my dad's fault, or stepmother, stepdad. If they hadn't gotten a divorce and this, then I would have been, if my grandparents hadn't been, that is not accepting responsibility. 6, begin taking definite steps to overcome your area of weakness, or areas. I don't want to limit it to just one. You may have an assortment. You may not just have one tumor. You may have a lot of tumors. So areas of weakness. Begin taking definite steps to overcome your area or areas of weakness. I want to suggest 6 principles that will be involved on this. Keep these things in mind. 1, it will not be overcome in a single effort. Your area of weakness is not going to be overcome in a single effort. We could have a meeting afterwards or an invitation afterwards and everybody recognize their area of weakness. Now, here, make a decision that area of weakness, that you have victory in that area of weakness beginning tonight. We have to be very careful when we do things like this. You can ask the Lord to begin to give you deliverance based on the positional truth that you have in Jesus Christ. But no one-shot decision is going to break that habit. You've got to learn by walking in the Spirit to put off the old and put on the new. So it will not be overcome in a single effort by some one-time decision. By the way, Peter's a good example of this. Peter's weakness, impulsiveness. And you will see a man who is in the process of changing from the Gospels to the Acts to 1st and 2nd Peter. Who wrote 1st and 2nd Peter, that's a changed man from the man back here out by the fire the night before the crucifixion. It takes time. Second principle involved is it will take the daily application of spiritual dynamics. It will take the daily application of spiritual dynamics. Here I refer you to the whole principle, all the principles that we studied in Romans 6 and 7 and 8. Recognizing our union with Christ, the fact that we are dead to sin, we do not have to live subservient to the power of sin any longer. We're free to serve Christ. Thirdly, don't reinforce your weakness by seeking out reinforcers. Don't reinforce your weakness by seeking out reinforcers like friends or places. If your area of weakness is a lack of self-control, let's say it's a lack of self-control in the area of sex, you're going to be very careful about where you go, with whom you associate. You're going to be very careful about television that you watch, the movies that you attend, the books that you read. You're going to recognize your need for strength, and you're not going to find reinforcers to your area of weakness. And I have seen people, Christians, who will do this by even seeking out other Christians who are weak in those areas. And they kind of work one another up. Well, this is the way I am, this is the way you are, ha ha, misery loves company. And you may find encouragement and support, but be sure that it's not reinforcing, though, and allowing you to justify your weakness. Abraham could find justification for what he was doing in his culture, but that didn't justify his action before God. So don't reinforce your weakness by seeking out reinforcers. If your area of weakness is that you tend to live by emotion rather than by fact and faith. Be careful lest you seek out people, churches, even preachers can cater to your weakness. 4. The longer it has been a part of one's life, the more difficult it is to remedy. Abraham used this policy at least 30 years. The longer it's been a part of one's life, the more difficult it is to remedy. Grace can handle it. God's enabling power can handle it. But if there is going to be some difficulty. That is why it's so important to identify and deal with this in the younger years, lest you fall under the principle of hardening. You become less sensitive, and you've learned to live with your weakness so long, and you've fallen in that area so long, that after a while you just don't care. That's dangerous. I think I've met some Christians like that. And they can just look at you very coolly, acknowledge their weakness, but really don't seem to be bothered about it. They just have learned, they've learned to live with it, and they're going to live with it. 5, it can be remedied by properly adjusting to the authority structures in your life. It can be remedied by properly adjusting to the authority structures in one's life. For instance, a wife can be tremendously helped by understanding the value of the authority structure in her life and her areas of vulnerability. She, the wife, will be particularly vulnerable without the spiritual leadership of her husband. And ladies, I want to make this point emphatic. You have areas of vulnerability and you have weakness in certain areas of your life if there is not the spiritual leadership of your husband. You have not only the areas of weakness that you may have naturally gone toward anyway, but you have special vulnerability without spiritual leadership. So you have a compounded problem. This is one reason why you'll often find women caught up in cults. This is one reason why you'll find women often getting off in tangents. You'll find them going off after some new teaching. Now, men are guilty of this too, but there's a special area of vulnerability for the woman without a spiritual leader. She's looking for some kind of leadership, and some women exercise discernment and reject that, and they stay under the authority of the Lord, and they find the authority of the church. That's something that we could talk about a little bit, that if there isn't the spiritual leadership from the husband, God's provided the authority structure of the church to help and protect. But when the woman begins to press out of this, this is one reason I think sometimes a woman who's bouncing around from Bible class to Bible class outside of the authority structure of a local church, she is a sitting duck for any fad that comes along the line. And she's going to be particularly vulnerable to tangents, to fads, to excesses. And her husband sees what's going on and says, what in the world is she into now? And she's off following she found a book somewhere, and she's off in this now, and she's gone off on that tangent. Now, husbands, they come back and lay it on you and me. We have a responsibility to meet the first basic need of our wife, and that's provide spiritual leadership. We don't. We make our wives vulnerable. So the authority structures are important here. School, I might add, as well as the home. It's important for the child to learn to face daily pressures, doing work right, handing it in on time. That is properly adjusting to their authority structure, lest they develop areas of weakness as they go along in life, like not being punctual, not doing consistent work. When they come to a pressure, backing away. I know a young man that he was not made to face pressures in school. Tests come up. Wake up in the morning, stomachache, headache, flu. His parents coddled him, allowed him to get away with it. Now you get, as an adult, a cripple, a real cripple. No, doesn't walk with a limp, walks with a mental limp. Now God's grace can change that, but you see how this area of weakness is developed. That is why proper adjustment to the authority structures can do a lot for remedying the situation. Teenagers, for instance, are particularly vulnerable. They have a particular area of weakness just because of the stage of life they're going through. teenagers have a special area of weakness in the matter of self-control and self-discipline. Now, it need not be that way. But I think what happens is often parents kind of let things go along, and then they decide when the child becomes 12 or 13, then they're really going to board the place up and get tight. Oh, it's getting a little too late then. Now, you'll have some special problems. That's just like a little colt and begins to kick up its heels a little bit and want to run around the pasture. But you better build a good fence, because that teenager has a special area of weakness and self-control. That is why the teenager needs some special protection in the matter of sex. That is why parents should have for their children some very well laid out, well explained, but very definite rules on relationship with the opposite sex. I'm talking about dating and things like that. This is the parent recognizing the area of vulnerability in their teenager and helping to protect them, because they have not, in most cases, developed enough self-discipline and self-control to handle it. And they get in situations that are out of their control. They're responsible, but they are particularly weak in that area. And you could see it in other areas, in driving problems, in drinking, and sexual relationships, and others as well. That's one of the values of authority structure for teenagers. That is why I think in a school that if a child can participate in a good athletic program or a good music program where they have to respond to an authority structure and they'll be made to do something, this will be something valuable for them in life, even if they're unbelievers. Even if they're unbelievers. You know, folks want to knock sports. And like, there is a criticism of football and baseball, or particularly football, like, well, it doesn't build character. Well, true, if you got a sorry coach and a sorry program, it wouldn't. But if it's run properly, young men will learn something in an athletic program. If it's run properly, they will learn something about self-discipline. And what they do with it is something else, but they'll learn that. So those things are important. It's not the whole picture, but it's important. 7. It can be, or 6 rather, 6. It can be remedied by determining what the basic needs are and what basic needs are not being met. You can help to take a definite step to overcome your area of weakness by determining what your basic needs are and what they are, and if they are being met. I'm talking about husband-wife relationship, children. We could have almost a whole hour just on talking about parents meeting the basic needs of their children to protect them from developing areas of weakness. Just important things like this thing of authority, or like punctuality, responding respectfully, and depression. Let's go to the 7th and final point. Finally, 7. Now, this is the major point. We might be a little conflict in your notes. The 6th was begin taking definite steps to overcome your area of weakness. 7, become familiar with the Christ-like qualities which counteract the works of the flesh. Become familiar with the Christ-like qualities which counteract the works of the flesh. Let me give you now a list of some areas of weakness and the area of Christ-likeness which will counteract that. So you see, we don't want to just, if we're going to handle an area of weakness, we've got to know what area needs to be worked on positively. What positive quality will counteract that negative trait, that influence that the sin nature has had in the life? Are you with me now? All right, let me do this and have a number of them. Anger. Is your area of weakness anger? Learn and look, and in the Spirit, develop meekness. Meekness. I don't have the time to go into what meekness is and all that. I'll just be able to go through the list. Harshness. Is your area of weakness being a very harsh, a very almost bordering on being cruel and insensitive? Gentleness. Find out what gentleness is. And in the Spirit, move in that direction. Thirdly, self-gratification or sexual lust. Inability to control yourself in the area of sexual lust. And this can include a number of things. Homosexuality. It can include masturbation. What is the positive quality? Self-control. Must learn. This is what one has to do in counseling. I've had to deal with people in the past. They come and there's this area where there's this obvious area of weakness. Their armor is really weak here. What can we do in the spirit to develop self-control? Identify self-control and how you can start taking steps. Jealousy. Is your area of weakness jealousy? What is it that counteracts and builds love? Jealousy is not love. It's an enemy of love. Judgmentalism, being judgmental. Judging other people without basis of fact. The Christ-like quality, discernment. Discernment. Self-pity. Is your area of weakness self-pity? Learn to put on peace. Learn what peace is. Slothfulness or laziness. Learn what diligence is. Take a concordance. Take the word diligence. Look it up. Find out how it behaves. What are its characteristics? You know what could be, this comes to mind, what you could do as a family, if you recognize there's an area of weakness in your family, and it's your area, and you see it beginning to happen in your children, you know what you can do as a family, be a healthy thing to do, is you just identify that thing with your whole family, and as a family you pray about it and work on it together. Don't play like it's not there. And you dads, if you see it, don't let pride stand in the way, but work on it together. Look at Bible characters. Take a man like Abraham and others, Samson, Jeremiah. See how God handled that in their life. See how God, if you have a problem with self-pity, take Jeremiah and see how God handled Jeremiah. Pride. In the place of pride goes gratefulness. Giving up. In the place of that, faithfulness or endurance. Insecurity. In the place of that, confidence. Gossip. What goes there? Self-control or goodness. Because if goodness is being developed, you're not going to seek to hurt people. You're going to be particularly sensitive to whether you're hurting people with your tongue. Loneliness. Counteract with hospitality. I've seen this in some lives. I have seen some young people who are single, who are particularly vulnerable to loneliness, and God has worked in their life, and they're some of the most hospitable people that I know of. And I'm always reminded that when I see some single person will sit around and feel sorry for themselves. Wants to go out and marry the first person comes along in a pair of pants or a skirt, as the case may be. And they're going to get married, and they're going to solve their loneliness. You learn to be hospitable first. God will take care of sending along another host or hostess. You learn to be hospitable. Inconsistency is replaced by dependability. Willfulness by obedience. Stinginess by learning what generosity is. Cowardice. Teach what courage is. I think I've seen something of this in a case that I might have a chance to work with. And I think I've seen this in a young man. I've seen a tendency to be afraid. I want to know why. Why is he a coward? And I would need to then to learn, not just to... See, this is where we can get into problems when if we deal with this in our children. If we just browbeat them about that weakness. You should. But what should we teach them to have in its place? All right, for cowardice, being afraid, what is courage? Courage is what would take its place. Develop that for them. Look up this word in a concordance and carry it through. And then gullibility. Area of weakness, gullibility. Or naivety. Being sort of a sucker for anything that comes along. What goes in that place? Discernment or discretion. teach what biblical discretion and discernment is. Well, I could go on and on and on. But this is the way you will start to build. And never forget, there is no such thing as a so-called little sin. Abraham failed in what he might have thought was a little sin, but it had far-reaching effects. So can our weakness. Let's pray. Father, dismiss us now with the work of the Spirit operating within us each, helping us to identify these things in our life and to grow in our Lord. Lord, that we might not dishonor you, bring reproach on your name, but glorify you in the manner worthy of your name, in Christ's name. Amen.